Christian Parenting.
This is Be Love, Do Good Podcast, and I'm your host, Christy Hayes, mama to two, founder of Be Strong Story, and author of the children's book, The Lunchbox Note, a true story of how a lunchbox note that said, be strong, protect the weak, love everyone, changed our life, and created a mission for our family. Join us each week for conversations that inspire our families to live out true compassion, kindness, and what it looks like to be love and do good in our communities. It may take us out of our comfort zones, you guys, but I promise it will put us on a path to see others, love others, and quite possibly change the world. Hey everyone, welcome to Be Love, Do Good Podcast. I'm your host, Christy Hayes, and today I have guest and author, Edward Grennan on. He's also the editor-in-chief for the past 24 years of Guidepost magazine and publications. He wrote a book called A Journey of Faith, A Mother's Alzheimer's, A Son's Love, and His Search for Answers. It's a beautiful, really kind of memoir, and I loved having him on and talking about this. Many of you know that we faced a similar journey with Grant's dad, and we moved to St. Louis to help take care of him. I had the privilege of being with him a couple times a day, and I just wanted Edward to come on and really talk about this. Many of us are in stages where we are taking care of our parents, but we're also taking care of our kids that are in our house. And so this is kind of that conversation where we talk about what does that look like and how does that impact us. And we really just start right in. You know, a lot of times when I talk with my guests, I kind of talk offline and then say, okay, now we're going to start the podcast. But I loved our conversation so much that I just kept recording it. So I hope you enjoy my interview with Edward.
I think, I mean, one of the reasons I wrote this book is because I learned in my own journey and much later that there are so many families, so many people like you and your husband who've had to carry this burden. And it's, you know, the disease itself, I mean, just in terms of the practical measures that have to be taken to care for a loved one with Alzheimer's, yeah. You know, that can be overwhelming. But the emotional and even the spiritual effects of the disease on a broad array of people and loved ones is incredible. And it's something I don't think, you know, we get enough help with now. So I'm hoping this book at least gives some people a sense that they're not alone. And that's one of the most important things, I think, you know, anyone can ever learn about their lives. And it's what's really been the foundation of Guidepost Magazine, is that you are not alone in your struggles and in your triumphs and joys, as well as your sorrows. There are others who can identify with it and whose strength is your strength, and likewise and vice versa.
You know, a lot of my audience is probably in the space where we're talking about caring for a parent, but also caring for our children. We're in that kind of middle space where we're taking care of both. And I know a lot of people who are also, you know, dealing with these kind of issues as well, who's, I actually have a, you'll love this story. There's a man who walks down, we have a path that we walk, and he walks with his wife daily. I take my kids to school and I always see him. And I always know that based on my father-in-law, I'm like, she has to have some type of Alzheimer's, because he's holding her hand. He's making sure she's getting to the right, you know, place. Every single morning they walk, same time. Well, about a year ago, he wasn't walking with her anymore. And I noticed it. And I told my kids, I said, hey, he's not walking with her anymore. I said, I think I'm going to go and see if he's, you know, if he, everything's okay. And of course, you have my 15-year-old son that's like, Mom, do not go over there and ask him. That's so weird. And then you have my daughter who's like, yeah, he was like, Mom, go ask him. You need to go walk with him. And so anyway, I went over and talked with him. Of course, by the end of the conversation, we're both bawling. He had to put his wife in a home. And so anyway, we become friends. And it's been about a year that we've texted each other, and we'll start walking together. And so just, there's so, it's just all around us, you know, that those people who are struggling with that is all around us. So it's very common, for sure.
Oh, it is common. It's going to get more become more common. There's upwards of 7 million, close to 7 million now, people who are suffering from dementias, which would be Alzheimer's and Lewy body and other related dementias. That's a huge number, would you consider? I mean, you multiply by say, 3 or 4 in terms of people who are immediately affected by that disease, and you're talking about an awful large chunk of the population mm-hmm. that's only going to keep growing and create incredible demands on the resources of the country, the most financial and emotional, in the coming decades, unless we find something that either prevents Alzheimer's or at least successfully treats some of the symptoms. And we pray every day that breakthrough comes. But in the meantime, you're right. I loved what you said about your interest in vulnerable populations mm-hmm. because you know, we're all vulnerable to some extent, absolutely. And a lot of us spend time running away from our vulnerabilities or denying them. But some people, you're right, are more vulnerable than others, mm-hmm. and they need our empathy for their vulnerabilities to be able to go through the world in a fulfilling way. And so often, these people with vulnerabilities are marginalized. And for a long time, I think people with Alzheimer's were marginalized. It was a term. I mean, the term itself is fairly recent. And until then, they were senile. They were dotty. They were, you know, they got shoved off in the corner of our lives. And, you know, even people with Alzheimer's who are in the mid to late stages of dementia, they still feel, you know, they still love us. And that's what the book. What I discovered is, for all the things that Alzheimer's destroys cognitively and physically and emotionally and mentally, that sense of love never is destroyed by Alzheimer's. Love and faith, which the two are, you know, in a sense one, that duality of love and faith, those two things never left my mother, even when everything else began to fade. Mm. It was still her love of her family and her love of God, which always came through.
As you kind of talk about your mother and your story, I noticed that when I was working with my father-in-law and just loving on him and kind of help taking care of him, a lot of his friends didn't know what to do with that. And when we talk about how those with Alzheimer's or those who are getting older still need people to treat them like they have purpose and that they are still significant. Tell me a little bit about that in your journey of watching your mother. And what would you say to people who are kind of going through this, or they have friends who are going through this? I noticed that people didn't know what to do, and so they just did nothing. They ignored it, or they didn't come around.
Yeah, the tendency is to withdraw, to become extremely self-conscious, and to some extent think that it's about you, and it's not, it's about them. What I learned, and it's hard, because I think it's hard for human beings in general to live in the moment, to be in the moment. And that is often where a person with dementia, particularly as they progress through the disease, they're living in the moment. So when my mother would say to me that she talked to somebody today and had a good conversation, I would think, that person's been dead for like 10 years. Mm. You know, my tendency is a rational and controlling human being is to say, no, Mom, you didn't talk to that person. They're dead. Don't you remember? Don't you remember? And it's that desperation in my own voice that I heard. Whereas in my mother's, there was a reason why she had that delusion, if you want to call it that. It's because something about that person and having conversations with that person was important to her. And, you know, we worry about whether or not it was a real conversation and understand that it was an important one for my mother and meet her there in the moment and say, and this is one of the things I learned, to say, oh, what did you talk about? And did you tell her, you know, about your new grandchild? Or did you mention, you know, that you got a new blouse or something? And go with it. So what if it's not real? Nothing is real in the end anyway. So why worry about what, you know, they need you there in the moment. They need you right now. And however upside down that might seem to a person who isn't suffering the ravages of dementia, you have to learn to put that aside and love them in the moment, because that's all they want. They want connection. They want to feel that love that they had felt for you for so many years. And the tendency is to somehow, for us, is to react against it instead of going with it.
How did you personally change, you know, your attitude? Or you said, you know, you at first would want to be like, no, Mom, that's not right. Or you know, we like to fix things, right? I think I noticed right. in the journey with my father-in-law is that we wanted to fix everything. We didn't really want to lean into it, which is so hard because as humans, we want to fix it. And this is something we can't fix.
Well, that for me was a sense, you know, it was one of the great faith challenges of dealing with a loved one with Alzheimer's is that you're not going to fix it. And that's really, really hard to accept on any level, particularly when it comes to someone you love as much as your parent or your spouse or a grandparent. And giving up that control to God, giving that up to whatever you view is greater than yourself, the universe, whatever, letting go of that and just saying that you're not going to fix this because nobody ever has. And the way that you can deal with it is to accept it and accept your powerlessness over it. It's a lot, you know, it's like a lot like the 12-step approach to addiction is to accept powerlessness and view that as a spiritual strength. And, you know, it was not an easy process for me, and it took the almost entire course of my mother's illness to understand that I was not the one who was in control and there was little I could do except be there for her and to love her and to accept her love, however flawed it became at times. And, you know, that was the cure, you know, to the extent there was a cure. And it's not so much a healing of the disease, but it's so much a healing from it.
You know, you talk a lot about hope in your new book, and that hope and love are the two things that even during this journey you can't lose. But one of the things that I thought was so sweet, my father-in-law, he was a runner his entire life. So for like 26 years, I think we counted, he did not miss one day of running, not one day. And so I remember that was the one thing that he wanted to do and he could do. And the one thing, I hate running, like it is not what I want to do ever, but I loved him. And so every day when I was with him, we would go for a run. And it's the thing that he remembered the most. And it was just, to me, it was like he remembered what it felt like. And it was the time that he felt free and outside of his body. You know, exercise does that to us. But I could tell when I was running with him, he felt like himself for maybe the first time that day. And I thought that was just the sweetest, like most impactful thing. And honestly, he ran, I remember he had a stint in the hospital and the nurse, you know, he was all like hooked up and he was going to miss that day of getting his, you know, at the time it was like he just had to get a mile in to count it for himself that he did it. And so I remember that my mother-in-law went down to get something at the cafeteria, and I went to the nurse and I said, look, I said, he's got to get this mile in. I need you to unhook his stuff. I need you to put him on a drip that he can walk around the place. I need you to put his tennis shoes on. We got 15 minutes to get his walk in so he can get in. And he got it in. But those things, you know, making those things important to him. And that's what our whole family did to make sure that he could do the one thing that made him feel, you know, himself. So I wondered if there was something that your family, you know, did as well with your mom.
Well, it's funny. My mother sounds a little bit like your father-in-law. She was a bundle of energy. I mean, she was always on the move. And she ran into her 70s. And then, you know, she became a walker. She was someone, you know, that would she'd go out in the middle of a snowstorm and shovel the driveway. And when everyone said, you're crazy, stay in, but she would go out there and do it. And she got a cold. Her cure for the cold was to scrub the kitchen floor and pray for other people who were sick.
Sweat it out.
You know, so, yes, I mean, she was just, you know, she was so, she came from a family of athletes, and she had been athletic as a young woman as well. So, you know, it was, you know, I used to always, you know, she was a great pacer, you know, and she would, you know, when she was in memory care, she wouldn't, you know, pace the hallways of her memory care unit. When I went to visit her, you know, the tendency is says, mom, sit down, just relax, sit down so we can talk. Yeah. I realized, no, I should walk with her. I should walk around the hallways, however, you know, crazy it might have seemed to me. And I knew that pacing and walking was a way for her to discharge physical energy, even in her middle and late stages of dementia, when she could still walk. So that's where I met her. You know, I learned over and over, meet them where they are. Don't try to drag them to that's where good. You are. You know, and the more you can do that, I think the easier it is to to ease their journey, because it's not a, it's by no means an easy journey. And the other thing with my mother is that her faith always was always there. I remember coming to visit her once, and she was, you know, she was in a Catholic campus for people with dementia, and they would say the rosary. And you know, even when my mother had lost that capacity to pray aloud, you could see her lips moving, even if she couldn't speak anymore. When they said the rosary, when they had prayer time, you could see how she was completely engaged with that. And even, you know, earlier when I would call her at her memory care unit and said, you know, what did you do today, Mom? Knowing that she had no memory, the only thing she always remembered was we had prayer time. She always remembered that. So there was something about faith that this disease was not going to conquer. And in my mom, that faith stayed until the very end. The last word she ever said to me was the word love. And she hadn't said anything in a long time. And it just, it goes, it for me, it proved that even in the terrible aspects of this journey, God is still there. I mean, and she was walking closer and closer to God every day. And my job was to walk with her as far as I was permitted to go.
As a son, I have a son. I'm very close with my son. He's 15. And I'd love to know, just from a son's perspective, what did you learn from your mother? What are some things that she taught you maybe before this Alzheimer's journey, but maybe even during the Alzheimer's journey that you'll carry with you, and that you would say, hey, this is something that I learned, but also maybe I give some advice to other mothers who have sons. What were some of the things that she left a lasting impression on you?
You know, I'm the fourth of four children, the youngest. I act like a young child. I'm a total brat, and I'm. Well into life now. I'm still a big brat, but
I love it. I'm the youngest too, so I feel your brattiness.
Yes,
too.
My brattiness. But between me, I had an older brother who was 4 years older than me, the third child in our family, who had Down syndrome, and it's really changed. It has an incredible influence on the dynamics of a family to have a child with special needs. And my parents loved Bobby. I mean, they were devoted to him. I remember, you know, when Bobby was born and he was the doctors were able to say he had Down syndrome. You know, the priests came to the house and they said, "Well, we have nuns and orders of nuns who are devoted to caring for these types of children, if you would like us to take him." And it's the only time in my life I ever saw my mother want to get up and slap a priest. I mean, they were incensed. They said, "No, we will have Bobby." And they did. They raised him. He died under somewhat mysterious circumstances when he was 12 and I was 9. And that was a shattering experience for my family. And it was a death that was never completely understood because he disappeared sort of mysteriously. And when his body was found a month later, it was never conclusive how that disappearance occurred and how he died. That aside, you would think that a mother who had only one more little boy to love would cling and hold on to that boy so tight that he would never breathe on his own, practically. And you know, my mother didn't do that, and I didn't realize the power of her being able to let me grow up and be as independent. And she knew I was the child who was most like her, very stubborn, independent, free spirit. Mm-hmm. That was my mother. She saw that in me, and even after the trauma of losing another son so mysteriously and so wrenchingly, she still let me have my freedom. I didn't realize it at the time, because when I was your son's age, 15-year-old, I was just awful. I mean, I was rebellious, and I was opinionated, and I thought I knew everything. And you know, my mother just let me go with it because she knew I needed to go through that, and she knew I needed to be my own person, and I could, you know, and she would teach me how, by her own independence, she would give me independence, learn how to stick up for myself and make my way in life. And I am incredibly grateful to her. And she would never have been able to do that. She could never have been able to let me be, let me have the freedom I needed to grow as a person unless she had complete faith that I was under the protection of a loving God.
That's good.
And you can see where she would doubt that after losing a boy so horribly.
Yeah.
And yet she let me be the person I needed. And I never realized that until much later in life. And I'm incredibly grateful to her and to God for that having happened in my life.
I love that. I think that helps me remember to just let go. You know, it's like stitched on every pillow, you know, let go and let God. And I make fun of those cliche statements, but honestly, as I'm, you know, have a kid who's a little bit older and he's precious right now, so I have no issues. But one day, we also have a daughter, so that could be the one who keeps us up at night.
Particularly your husband. Yeah,
exactly. So, but it's one of those, it's true. It's knowing that our kids are not really ours. They've always been God's. We get to care for them. We have the privilege of journeying with them and teaching them about our faith. But at the end of the day, we do not have control over who they become and the choices that they make. And so it does give us a little bit of, to me, It feels good to let God do his thing and to know that I just get to journey with that. So thanks for sharing that.
Right.
As we
Okay. You know, I was just going to say, when I was a teenager, I'd give a man to my mother. My mother would say, well, I'm praying for you. You know, that's how we'd end an argument. She'd say, okay, I'm praying for you. And I would say, would you stop praying for me? I mean, I don't need it. Just pray for somebody who needs it. I don't need it. I don't want it. And she said, what, am I not allowed to pray for you? I have the freedom to pray for everyone I pray. Don't tell me who to pray for. But, you know, we would fight about whether she was allowed to pray for me. You know, to know wherever I went in the world later on, in some of my darkest periods, because I suffered from terrible addiction problems and depression, you know, and through part of my life before I became came to Guidepost, and knowing then in those darkest moments that my mother was praying for me when it seemed like nothing on earth was going to save me from what I was doing to myself, to know that at least I had her prayers meant everything. And I wanted to take back all those things. You know, the last conversation I ever had with my mother, she was on her deathbed, I told her how sorry I was for what I had done, even though I knew she had forgiven me long ago. And sometimes it feels almost selfish to unburden yourself to someone who's dying, you know, but I needed to say, those prayers that you said, even when I was at my worst and was rejecting everything, those prayers meant everything to me, and they probably saved my life.
As we kind of wrap up our time, I feel like I could talk for hours with you. Tell me some advice for someone who's walking through this right now. So maybe they're in the overwhelming, whether it be Alzheimer's, dementia, or whether it be a cancer diagnosis, or just something that has wrecked their world, and they're like right in the middle of it. What would the advice that you would have for them be?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because one of the ideas I started with when I worked on this book is I wanted it to help people beyond the Alzheimer's community, by the people who have the disease or family members who have been affected by someone who's had it, that this is a book that can help you, you know, cope with any difficult patch in your life. And you know, we're all going to have them, and we're all going to have periods of when we look back on our lives and see that there were some very hard times, or sometimes very hard years, or even decades, where we struggled and really had to fight our way through that time. What I did find, and to say this just as an aside before I get to your question, is that my greatest periods of growth, particularly spiritual growth, but emotional growth too, were in the tough times. It's where I grew spiritually. I love when life is as smooth as a mill pond and everything's going well. But I've never found them to be particularly periods of great growth or self-knowledge or a closeness to God. So, you know, in those sense, those are, growth periods. One thing I've learned, and I've learned this from the Alzheimer's journey, I've learned this from 12-step and from the Bible, really, is to stay present. If there's a lesson in this book, and if there's a lesson I've found in life, is the more you live in the now, the more you step out of the past and resist trying to dive into the future, the more that you can live in the moment, the richer your life will be, and particularly spiritually, because that's where God meets us. He doesn't meet us in the future. He will when we get there. Mm-hmm. But, he meets us in the moment. And that's when we need our faith and our belief in God. And if there's one lesson from this book, I would say I want to pass on, is that need to fight our instinct to project or to get lost in the past and dwell on our regrets and try to push that aside. It's like you're going through this huge field of wheat and you want to push all that chaff aside and go forward into a clear path, which is the path of now, the path of the moment. And then in dealing with an Alzheimer's patient, their world is flying apart before your eyes. And you just have to know that you're not going with it. As everything flies apart in their life, you're still there. And whatever it takes to just stay with that person, even in those periods of time where you think they're pushing you away, just be there. Always be there. Don't judge anyone who has this disease, no matter what they say. And they may say some horrible things. My mother, for instance, never uttered a swear word in her life. I mean, she was the most – she just wouldn't do it. And yet, as she got into Alzheimer's, she said some words I didn't even know that she knew. right. I remember she had this one orderly at her memory care unit. I think I can say this on your podcast, who she didn't like for some reason. And when I was there one day with her, and she came in to fill my mother's water carafe, and then she left, and my mother said, "Thank you." And as the woman left, she said, "Fat ass." And I thought, oh, my God. Gosh, how did my mother know that? And I wanted to jump up and say, "Don't talk like that." But I realized, we're going to find out things about our loved one as all of those inhibitions are stripped away by the disease, and it's okay. It's fine. It's not terrible. Grab their hand and squeeze it whenever you can, just to let them know you're there, and tell them that you love them. No matter, even if you don't think they can hear you, tell them anyway. One of the directors of the memory care unit told me, because I was living in New York and she was living in Michigan, she said, "Send her cards. They love to get cards. And just write, I love you. I'm thinking about you. I'm praying for you." Even if it goes in, they forget an hour later that you sent them a card. Just meet them in that moment. Whatever you do, a phone call. Or even just, call them up and hum a tune that they love. Something that just anchors them in the moment and know that they're still connected to you, even as the rest of the world is disintegrating for them.
Yeah, and I think what I hear you say is that total and complete acceptance and love, regardless what they give you in return. I think that's what I've learned through watching my mother-in-law and our family, love my father-in-law, is that it's complete acceptance with and truly what love is, what God's love is to us, is that he's never wanting something in return. He loves us because we are his. He loves us because he loves us. We don't have to give anything in return. With Alzheimer's and love them is that they are loving unconditionally. And I would just say to those also who might be maybe not in this with a family member, but maybe they have a friend who's going through this, to lean in. I think that's the thing I always wanted to tell my father-in-law's friends is lean in, keep visiting him, keep hanging out with him. Yes, it will look different. Yes, you might not know what to say. I would invite them all. I would go to a restaurant with my father-in-law, the same restaurant, because they would make the things that he needed to eat. And I would invite his friends. And what I noticed is that his friends, they were silent. They didn't know what to say or really what to do. And I remember just taking him aside and saying, just be yourself. Like, maybe just mm-hmm. because he's not going to respond the way that you normally that he would. He loves having you here. He knows you're here. Just lean in. Be there. Don't check out because it's uncomfortable. I find that when it's uncomfortable for people, they check out instead of right. leaning in. So I would say lean in, be uncomfortable, but just be there.
It's true. It's not about you, and it's hard for any of us human beings to believe anything is not about us. Right. But it is. And you're right. Lean in. Be there. Even if your loved one says, I hate you, go away. You say, I love you, and I'm going to stick around for a little bit. Then I'll go away. Don't worry. And, that sense, they want, there are people who tell you they want you to go away when they really want you to stay. Mm-hmm. And you have to let them know that you're going to stay. And I think that's true with anyone who's going through any type of crisis, not just something as dramatic and overt as Alzheimer's, but, I found a lot of the things I learned about addiction were true with Alzheimer's, and they're true with people who are going through addiction, which is another terrible disease that in a sense is incurable, but it is treatable. And it's so easy to shrink away from someone in the throes of addiction as it is with someone in the throes of Alzheimer's when you really need to lean in and hold on to them, to let them know, because they're going into a terrible spiral that you can't possibly understand.
True. Well, Edward, I loved our conversation. Thank you so much.
I did
thank
too.
Thank you for writing this book, A Journey of Faith, A Mother's Alzheimer's, A Son's Love, and His Search for Answers. I'm excited for people to read this. And thank you so much for just sharing your heart and sharing your journey.
I love talking to you, Christy. And I do want to say, if you want to order the book, it's available at shopguideposts.org. And that's shopguideposts.org, and then, or you can get it from Amazon, like everything else.
Like everything else. We will put everything in our show notes, and we love having you. Thanks for what you do at Guidepost as well. We couldn't, I've read that forever. My mom will be so excited you're on this as well, because she loves Guidepost. She sends me the little articles that I need to read and the encouraging things
yes. that I need. Classic. That's really, Guidepost is the most shareable thing you can have. It's been wonderful, and thank you for letting me talk to you and your audience.
I love it. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed this podcast as much as I did with Edward. And even though you might not be facing this right now, I know that this will give you just a bit of encouragement as we go through the different things with our families and parents. I encourage you to get his book. You can get A Journey of Faith at Guidepost, shopguideposts.org, or you can grab, of course, on Amazon as well. But if you get his book on the Guidepost, you're going to get 2 free gifts as well. I hope you have a great day. I hope you have a wonderful week. And thank you so much for being love and doing good in your families and community. We'll see you next week.